there again. This is Creative Block. My name is Kyle Marshall, and I am the owner of Media Lab YYC, which is located in lovely Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And man, do I wish I could take a good photo. Today's conversation happened in a bit of a roundabout way. I was suggested to talk to Amy Brathwaite because Jess Huffman, who works here at The Bridge and is the co-owner of The Bridge, suggested that I sit down and talk with her. She used to live here in Calgary, but has also lived all around the world and has now delved into a career of photography and videography. And I agreed that that sounded like somebody who was right up my alley. Well, I didn't know how much up my alley it would actually be until I was able to talk with her over Skype and found out that she had this entire career in global relief and aid. And, well, I mean, you're just going to have to listen to it. There is a lot to get into with just that. And what I really appreciated as well is how vulnerable she decided to be with me, a complete stranger, and let's face it, it's Halloween, a ghostly ghoul of a man. So definitely you're going to want to stick around and listen to that. But before we do have a couple of sponsors this week. Our first sponsor is Let's Do Coffee. Let's Do Coffee is a podcast that's hosted by Daniel Van Veelen and produced by the Maji Center for New Venture and Student Entrepreneurship at NATE. Each episode features an interview with a student entrepreneur or NATE alumnus. They dive into topics and explore their challenges, questions, and fears involved in operating their companies. It seems like an idea that I have no way to sympathize with. You can find the show at nate.ca/Maji Center. That's NAIT.ca/MAWJI Center. And of course, probably the easiest way to do this is that there will be a link to it in the show notes to this episode. I can't believe I've gone so far without telling you that Creative Block is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. Of course, I should mention that the Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. ATB is our other sponsor this week. ATB supports artists and creatives of all kinds, which is why they have the Branch for Arts and Culture. If you're an artist, check out ATB's Branch for Arts and Culture. It's a bank, music venue, and creative space all in one. So ATB can help you if, say, you have this amazing idea that you want to create this energy drink, right? You see all the ghastly monsters that are coming out of the woodwork right now. Tomorrow is Halloween. So you have your Frankenstein monsters, your vampires, your werewolves, your invisible men, your mummies. All of them are walking the streets. You collect them all. You find a group of them. You put them into this cauldron. You stamp them down into that cauldron and you pulverize them. And you liquefy them so that you can put their essence into a 20-ounce can. You call it Monster Mash, and you sell it for a profit. It is there. I'm giving you this idea. Pay me royalties. Anyway, ATB can help you fulfill your dream at the Branch for Arts and Culture. You can go to atb.com/thebranch to find out more. I mentioned the show notes already, but there's going to be a lot of links into there for you today. Not only will you see Amy's website that you can go and peruse, which I definitely recommend doing, she also mentioned quite a few books in our conversation, so I've linked to all of those here today, which may or may not be affiliate links if I can figure out how to do that. Regardless, there are links to all the books that she talks about. Also, just so that you're prepared, she did send in a separate little piece of audio after we were done our conversation, which I have attached right at the beginning of the credits of this episode. So don't click away right as you hear that final music. There is just a little bit more from Amy at the very end of this episode. But if you want to find out more or learn more about today's guest, the show notes are definitely going to be where you want to go. I will also pitch to you that if you think you have a great guest, or maybe that guest is even you, who I should interview on this show, send those recommendations to info@medialabyyc.com. So thank you to all the sponsors, but now let's get into my conversation with Amy Brathwaite. This one was just really good. In this conversation, you're going to hear about aid work, sliding into the DMs, and forgotten cousins. Let's go to that now. Amy Brathwaite, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
One thing I'd like to start off with, just in case, is maybe you could explain just a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
I'm an artist. I'm a former humanitarian worker. I do photography and videography and communications, and I'm sort of carving life out as a creative entrepreneur at the moment.
Was there a specific time in your life where you knew that that was what your direction was going to be?
No. Well, I think there's always been that. I've always had an artistic side to me. But I think in looking back, I had it always a part of what I did creatively on the side or what I enjoyed doing in my personal projects and that sort of thing. But to kind of dive in as a profession, no, that wasn't something that I explored. I think, you know, the usual narrative when you're a young person about what possibilities lie as an artist in this world are not usually often promoted. So what I did end up studying and pursuing was development and international relations, and spent quite a bit of time overseas in that kind of work before sort of this constant evolution, but this current transition that I'm in now, where I'm more in a creative field.
Was that something that you like went to university for, or post-secondary, as far as like development and aid work?
I think there was always a compulsion there, but I actually studied at the University of Calgary back in the day. And then I went on to pursue a master's degree in development and international relations in a city called Aalborg in Denmark. Mm. So studied there for 2 years, and that leveraged me to different there were some government placements through the Government of Canada, through what was once CEDA, the Canadian International Development Agency, and that got me exposure to the UN and other organizations that I then worked with for some time.
So forgive my ignorance here. When you say development, like what specifically are you learning about in those classes?
Interestingly, after working in the field, like I worked in Bangladesh, and I started out on an internship in Tanzania, which took me to Bangladesh and on to Indonesia and Haiti. Oftentimes, I think, you know, in looking back on my curriculum and some of the skills that may have been required, or some of the things that I may not have considered at the time that I entered the profession, those may have been helpful to mm-hmm. reflect on. But going back, I mean, I graduated some time ago. But, you know, theories of development, which again have massively evolved, and the whole aid infrastructure and aid system is going through a major transition. So it's an interesting time, because probably anything that I would have learned at the time, right. Not to say that it's irrelevant, but it practices, policies, laws, circumstances in the world are constantly evolving, and things need to shift with it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. Like I remember like me growing up in the 80s and 90s, where you would see, usually for me, Sunday mornings, where you would have like an infomercial that would pop on, and you'd see like the really depressed children and like, please give to us, that sort of thing. But that seems to have really changed here recently, where there is just either companies know or feel like they're compelled to do some sort of social good, or you have like water.org or heifer.com and stuff like that, where people here really feel like they're making an impact and not just giving money to an organization, but they can really mm-hmm. see what their impact is. I guess you'd be more positioned to know if overall that's a better thing, or I don't know. What are your thoughts on where aid and giving are right now?
Well, I think from the perspective of what you talked about, the narrative that we grew up with, you know, with the poor, sad children with the flies on their faces, I think thankfully that has evolved. It depends. There's still organizations that use that narrative, but I think it's been more aptly called poverty porn these days. And I think one of the real advancements has been the evolution in empowerment and challenging the traditional narrative, because, you know, a lot of major disasters, there's a time of reflection after, and you can, I think, there's still a long way to go, but voices from communities are rising up, and there's so much competencies in the countries in which disasters occur that, in my own experience, that's been something that I've grappled with over the years, and probably moving farther and farther away from those organizations, not because of the work that they're doing, but I think just my changing relationship with it. And, you know, I can think of the team that I worked with in Indonesia, the the people and the colleagues that I were surrounded with had decades of experience of working in small to medium scale to large scale disasters in their country, and building relationships with government officials and designing disaster reduction policies, getting early warning systems in place, all sorts of preventative and preparedness activities, because they understand the context, the language. And so I think that was a really important model for me to, in a really strong environment for me to learn in, and really challenged the narrative that I might have been exposed to growing up, and certainly in challenging this notion that there's this sort of the savior complex that comes in, because I think people are really tired of that, and it's really time to change.
Yeah, I guess it's
changing.
It's getting to that point where it's more, let's give you the tools so that we can prevent this from continuing to happen, instead of just being like that Band-Aid that comes in and helps out.
And I think also when you spoke to the idea that, you know, whether or not people are more engaged, I think there is an increase in people's involvement and awareness of when they give, and maybe making more demands as to where they would like their money to go. But I think there's that's important, but I think it can be a slippery slope between then, I don't know, how do I say this? In some directions and in some initiatives, things can turn a little self-serving, or you question who are you really benefiting in this particular case.
Right. Yeah. Were you born in Calgary?
No, I was born in Manitowoc, Ontario, in the Northwest.
Wow. Okay. Yeah,
and lived in Alberta a little bit when I was a child, just outside of Calgary. And then I sort of feel like my life has kind of been split between Ontario and Alberta over the years. I feel tied to both provinces, but
Where is the true center of the universe then in that case? Is it Ontario or Alberta?
I think we all have our own access. And I'm not getting into that debate. I have been lucky to live and experience other parts of Canada and know how beautiful and vast it is. And I have my own relationship with Toronto.
Yeah.
Say that.
So how big of a town then was the place in Ontario?
Where I was born?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It was quite small, and I think it's probably really the population has maybe dwindled over the years. I'm not sure. I've only driven past a sign a few years ago, but it was a mining town, quite thriving at the time. And my dad was a teacher and my mom was a nurse, and they decided to have an adventure way up in the north. They were from Southern Ontario, and my dad got a job in this place called Manitowoc, northeast of Thunder Bay, I think, by about 3 hours. So, yeah.
So then where would you say you predominantly grew up in?
I guess Ontario, but between, you know, my youth or my childhood in Alberta till I was 8 or 9, and then, you know, till I was about 19, from 9 to 19 in Ontario, and then moved back west.
Right, right.
And then I've been a bit of a gypsy soul mover. Yeah, I've been moved around a few times.
Well, I like asking this question to people because I just get so many different answers. But do you recall the first thing that you ever became obsessed with?
Probably something in and around photography, truthfully. Between photographs, cameras, and taking pictures, I think there's been always that creative pull in that regard. I remember National Geographic's and this particular hardcover book that my parents had called Our World. And I used to go through photos and a bit of a text by country. And I would go through each country. And I remember smelling the pages because I thought that maybe would be what the place would smell like. And when I traveled there one day, would there be some kind of long lost recognition in those early pages? But probably travel and photographs, I would say, were quite strong.
Yeah. I mean, you joke about it, but I still like the smell of a really good book. I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
there's certain smells of that paper when you first open it up.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Now, I know that you eventually got to that place, but were you there? Not mentors is the wrong word, but inspirations, like people that you were followed in the photography trade? Was there this person does great work? Or was that even something that you were thinking about at that time?
I don't know if I could have placed individual names as much as I've always been a visual person, a visual learner, and drawn to, like I've always made art or, you know, been drawn even to images in magazines that I would keep if there was, you know, the particular light, you know, or the crispness. I've always been drawn to black and white. Mm. So probably, like Ansel Adams, like definitely learning from some of the classics, but, late in my later years, probably David Duchemin. He's a humanitarian photographer. He's based out of Vancouver. But I would say it's just sort of consuming a lot of visual material and really being drawn to particular images and what they represented, and definitely a style that would intrigue me. Mm-hmm. But I've sort of had time and space for lots of different things it was like wading through lots until I started to carve out a sense of style and what really resonated, and then maybe digging deeper from there.
Right. How did you like school?
I did like school. I think I was able to sort of navigate. I mean, it's easy to look back now and say, oh, it was great. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure there were times. I think moving across the country when I was 8 or 9 from Alberta to Ontario was a bit difficult. And those years of sort of the early elementary were challenging. But I think, you know, in retrospect, I was, you know, I was always drawn to the arts, to phys ed, geography, and I was able to navigate different groups, and I could sort of get on with most people, and things like, you know, if there was somebody that was being bullied, like I remember that really being troubling. Mm-hmm. I was my valedictorian for mm-hmm. high school, and my grade eight and my high school valedictorian. So, that was interesting to look back upon. And it was funny, I actually found, you know, I was going through some things the other day and found one of my old yearbooks and read the speech that I wrote when I was in high school for my graduation. And it was interesting to sort of look back at myself at 19 and think, okay, there's some wisdom that I could take and apply to myself now, because it's been a roller coaster.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Kind of the same thing. When I look back every so often, I'll come across something that I wrote or a card or something that I sent to somebody, like pops back into my life after like 15 years or something like that. It's like, who wrote this? Oh, I wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I need this right now, actually. This is some good advice that I'm
giving
to myself.
You're wise. I need to listen to you.
talking about that thing about like connecting the dots back through our life, I do think it's true that oftentimes we don't understand the significance of certain things until we start to look backwards and be like, oh, okay, so that led to this and this led to that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Do you know of anything, or does anything jump to mind of something that you didn't think much about in your past, but now thinking back on it was very important?
One thing that comes to mind is, I don't want to say that I was naive about going out into the world, but I admire the fearlessness in which I didn't really question or be afraid of, you know, I went to England in my third year of university, which led to me meeting random Australians in London, to going to Australia for a year after I graduated with no plan. I've never been a planner. and just the idea of, I'm going to work my way around this country. And I think that still exists in me, but you know, as you know, things change, or, you know, I admire the fearlessness in which I just threw myself in. And I remember my mom saying to me, and I didn't think much of it, but she said, aren't you nervous about going to Australia? You don't know anybody. And I said, strangers are friends I haven't met yet or something. And she was like, whoa, where did you come from? But I think that, maybe that innocent fearlessness was something that I may have taken for granted at the time that I look back with and think, that was pretty ballsy and cool that you did that at 21 or 22.
Is traveling something I guess you would recommend people do? Like, what is it that you got out of traveling to like England and to Australia and to these other different places that you may not have been able to get by just staying at home?
Oh, I got the world. I mean, I have... Yeah, I mean, probably some of the best people, and people that you may never see again or even connect with, but just kind of molded by the experiences of beautiful places of different landscapes, of different people, of living in different religious countries and, you know, adhering to different cultural practices and learning about your own inner pendulum, the capacity to love somebody from a completely different place and a completely different language from you, the commonality that we all share of really just kind of wanting better things for our kids, wanting safety, some work, a home. Like, there's so many things that I find priceless. Like, you know, even in times when I feel that I'm, you know, maybe not where, if I'm not settled, quote unquote, whatever that means, or I haven't figured it out, I think I wouldn't trade any of the experiences that I'd had for, you know, an increased sense of security or assets, whatever it is. I've been gifted the world. And I think those kind of experiences have stayed with me for the rest of my life and offered a perspective that is hard to shake, whether it's, you know, seeing people just leave the tap on for too long and thinking, oh my goodness, you're just wasting that resource, or just a sense of perspective. And I think, and in this time where things are really feeling a little bit distressed, it's kind of a bit, it's jarring because you think we are so innately connected to each other, and these definitions of borders and things, like, we're all really connected. And if things are going to be a bit more challenging, like, we got to hurry up and recognize that and collaborate.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could remember who said it so I could give proper credit, but I've always remembered it because I heard it when I was a teenager, and it's always stuck with me. But the idea that if we actually had a friend in every country in the world, then it'd be really hard to go to war with those countries, because, like, hey, I know this person over here.
I have said that before about international relationships.
Right, right.
I have so many friends that are, you know, that have married somebody from another country. And we've all said, you know, if everybody kind of had another place's back, mm-hmm. imagine if we all just used an example like that, instead of being afraid of one another and our differences, if we just, yeah, I've said that before. That's interesting.
Yeah. So you graduate with your master's. What is your next step after that? Like, what did you start to apply for as far as jobs go?
I was quite fortunate. I finished my thesis in May and defended it in June of 2005. And then in August, I started a placement at UNDP, which was the UN Development Program in Dhaka, Bangladesh, a couple months later. So it was a young professionals program, funded through the government with partnerships with UN agencies around the world. And I was working in a HIV health program. So that's kind of where things kicked off for me.
Sure. What was your day-to-day like? Like, what were your responsibilities?
I worked in an office to dispel a lot of myths. Getting there was interesting, but I largely worked in an office. One of the big initiatives was to implement Kofi Annan's global learning strategy on HIV/AIDS. So he wanted all staff and their families to be informed about HIV/AIDS and how it's transmitted and how you can protect yourself, and kind of demystifying some of the stigma and misinformation around HIV. Mm-hmm. So part of that was facilitating, organizing and facilitating these workshops with a lot of staff across the field offices across Bangladesh. So that did involve some travel within the country, including the Chittagong Hill Tracks area, which is near where the Rohingya crisis is right now. So it's interesting knowing that area and how impoverished it is prior to this humanitarian catastrophe. So it personalizes a lot of things that you might just hear in the news, and then it takes you back to those moments. But it was a lot of paperwork. It was a lot of meetings. It was a lot of coordinating and working in an office. But I would, you know, I wore shalwar kameez or saris because the custom dictated that I dress more modestly.
How long did you stay there for?
I was there for almost a year, I think. Yeah, it was close to a year. And it was an incredible time. It was challenging. It was hard, but it, you know, changed a lot of things. And I was sick a lot in ways that I'd never been before or imagined. it was interesting.
What was the next step after that? Where'd you go to after that year?
I went to India for a little while and did some traveling in the north and the northwest parts. And then I went back to Ottawa, actually. I'd never lived in Ottawa before, but I went to Ottawa and worked for an organization there that actually sent me on the program. So I became a project officer at UNA Canada, which was the UN Association in Canada. And they, at the time, had these internships or young professional programs for young Canadians, but I believe most of the government funding has been lost. And in fact, the day, I think 2 weeks into me starting my job, where I moved from Bangladesh and moved to Ottawa, which was a shock in and of itself, the government cut the funding. So that changed the game. So I was going to Parliament Hill and trying to advocate for these professional programs because they ended up transitioning to self-employed internships, which I really struggled with, because one of the advantages of the government programs is they gave geographic representation, and it didn't matter about, you know, your level of finances. It was a across the board equal opportunity. And so these self-funded internships I really struggled with, and actually had a really big moral conflict about, because I thought, you're just going to perpetuate the system of rich people only having access to these kind of opportunities, which may lead to work, which then keeps this sort of entrenched and more privileged population working there. So,
I mean, not to get too political here, and if you don't want to answer this, this is fine, but where do you think the balance is between like government support of aid versus like individual contributions? Like, what do you think the partnership there should be?
I don't really feel equipped to answer the question thoroughly. But I do believe in both addressing and caring for people in our country, and also recognizing that the percentage that we perceive that we give and the percentage that actually is received is very different. And there are a lot of, you know, as anything, there's challenges and inauthentic operations in all sectors, but there are also really, there's imperative and important work happening in the world that saves lives daily. So I definitely believe in, again, it comes from that perspective of this global community of helping people out, as naive as that can sound.
Well, I mean, when you look back on your career in aid and helping people, is there something that you're specifically the most proud of?
That's really puzzled me. That's really stumped me. I think over the years, I've really questioned, not that I did harm, but I think there was a level of idealism and naivete that I had when I first started. And it was knocked out pretty early with my first experience, which I don't think I will get into, but it was not the best example of a starting point. And that was prior to Bangladesh. It was a really ad hoc organization, and I think they had some really questionable practices. So I think it knocked some of that idealism out, but,
it somewhat reminds me of, again, I can never remember who says these things, definitely not me, but the idea that the people who are politicians are sometimes not the best people to be politicians, and like the people that could really do a lot of good and like initiate that change are scared out of it just because of the kind of toxic nature of what politics eventually becomes. Not to say that it's a direct comparison to what you were talking about, but I think that the people who are like are idealistic and the people who want to make the most change are often, unfortunately, like crushed underneath the bureaucracy of all these organizations that are around. But
and also can really do harm. If I'm, you know, they can really do harm if you just go in and thinking that your sunshine ways and like I think that Haiti probably was an example of really some practices that were really, that just felt really opportunistic and advantageous. And the question would come up, whose agenda are you serving? And I think just over the years, like books like Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Work by Jessica Alexander, The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster by Jonathan Katz, The Rainy Season and Finding or Farewell Freddy by Amy Wentz. Like, these are all books that really deconstruct and pull back some of those idealistic layers that we might presume about aid, and really dig deep, and I think have left left me with recognizing how much more complicated I even thought it was, and also kind of wondering, oh, what was I? Was I a part of a larger system that was hurting or harmful? Or all I can look back on and think about how I behaved and how I engaged in those places, and I can hold my head high about that and how I, the relationships that I've developed. And I think there were a lot of positive things that happened, but this has probably been a really profound time of reflection on Haiti in particular. And also I acknowledge that I haven't been part of that work for a little while. So I can't speak to, you know, how conflict has shifted aid and aid crises that we're seeing now, and how aid workers are more under attack than they ever were. Like the landscape has shifted, since I was a part of it. So
during all this time then, how are you developing your photography and video skills? Because I know that's kind of what you're doing now. So was this something that you were doing concurrently?
Well, after Haiti, I moved. I was quite burnt out after Haiti. And that's when I decided to come back to Canada and sort of change gears. And that's what led to the production of my short documentary. But it was in that time that I was working full time as a photographer. There was a woman I knew, my cousin, not a woman that I knew, my cousin.
Right.
has a successful...
She's like at every family gathering for some reason.
Yes, that's who it is. She has a successful photography business in Calgary. So we had done some traveling together. And I think she recognized that I might have wanted to change gears for a little bit and work in a creative environment. So I worked with her as an associate photographer. And so that was really kind of the start of working full time in that environment. And did that for a couple of years in Calgary and really built a really vibrant, fun community there. And really just, I think Calgary really surprised me, and it took me time, especially after moving directly from Port-au-Prince to Calgary, Alberta. Again,
you like to do these drastic transitions.
But it was home for a while, and but I was laid off as a result of the downturn in Alberta a couple years ago. So I think I had been away for so long. I had been overseas for so long. I had always lived far away from my family, where I would just see them once or twice a year, that I thought, you know, I don't have any really big financial ties in Calgary. And so I decided to make the move east again. It was difficult, but the energy and almost this palpable anxiousness about the city and money and work just erupted in 2016. And I decided that I would try to reconnect back in Ontario. So that's what has brought me back here.
Tell me about the short documentary then that you made.
Well, perhaps I was alluding to it with my other questions about aid, but when I was in Haiti, I found myself, I think I really transformed over that time. And I think when I moved to Calgary, it gave me the opportunity to exhale. And in doing so, I think I recognized maybe the depth of some of the level of my exhaustion, exhaustion of being inundated and living and working in such an intense environment with so much struggle and suffering, I think really burnt me out. And while I was afforded the opportunity to take better care of myself, I started doing things like yoga and Reiki and acupuncture. And a lot of this body pain that I was experiencing, I was working with this incredible acupuncturist in Calgary. His name is Don Wensrick. Shout out to Don. He's amazing. I see him every time I go at Primasai on 14th Street and 17th Ave.
He
first saw me, and he didn't know anything about me. He didn't know anything about the work that I had done, and I was complaining about wrist pain, and I thought it was the heaviness of my camera. And I went to see him, and he said, "I don't know where you have been or what you've been doing, but the pain in your wrist is not, it's not your wrist, sweetheart." He said, "You are carrying around and you are heavy with other people's suffering and sadness and struggle." And he said, "Some of it is your own, but a lot of it is other people, and you're heavy with it."
Wow.
You know, so that, you know, I felt like he really saw into me in a way that maybe I'd never permitted or never believed, or had been on this adrenaline rush for so many years, that I was in a safe place, the unexpected city of Calgary, where I could kind of let go of some of the heaviness and the just, you know, like working in that struggle. And not to make it all about myself, but what I could see in other people as well was people also being affected, and then and reacting in such a way that was maybe harmful to themselves. And definitely when you're working with populations that are vulnerable, it can be volatile. So I was out for a walk with a friend of mine, and we went for a cup of tea, and I was telling her about this idea about how I could sort of articulate and tell this story. And I could picture images in my mind. I could picture the things that I knew would articulate this unnamed thing of amongst aid workers. And she just gave me a napkin and a pen. She said, you need to write this down and you need to like tell the story. So I started a crowdfunding campaign, and I explained the kind of the ethos of the project and what I wanted to talk about. And I pictured a photo documentary or a photo series, but just over time it evolved to become a documentary. So
what was it called?
It was called Kick at the Darkness, the exploration of the psychosocial impact of humanitarian work, or something like that. Something breezy like that.
Yeah, rolls right off the tongue. Can people see this right now? Like, can they go and like download it, watch it, rent it? Anything like that?
It is. Well, it's a short documentary. It's about 10 minutes long, but it is on my website at amybrathwaite.com. And you can see it on the main page. There's a gallery for Kick at the Darkness. And there's a picture of me in Haiti there. And you just click on that and you can see the link. So, and then there's some interviews that I did with the Calgary Eye Opener. And I was on CTV speaking about it and a few other places. So it was cool to get that kind of recognition and to enhance and remove some of the silence and stigma around this kind of unspoken aid worker burnout thing.
Yeah. I mean, just having talked with you now for whatever it is, about 40 minutes, but one of my favorite movie critics of all time, Roger Ebert, once said that the best movies are empathy machines, where you're meant to watch them and really feel for the people that you're watching in like a different situation or a different background. Mm. And I think that photography is a similar case, where at least if you're doing portrait photography, there should be some sort of emotion that you're attaching to that, and you should feel for the people that are in those photos. I feel, just looking at your website even right now, and the photographs that are presented there, that they are empathy machines, where I feel something every time I look at one of them. Is that something, I guess, consciously that you're going after? Like, are you trying to capture a feeling, or what is it that, I guess, motivates you to take a picture?
Well, I value authenticity, and I value natural light. And I think that speaks to that mixes with the authenticity. It's real, it's natural. And I love capturing those moments of joy or moments of just where people are really allowing themselves to be seen, even if it's just for a shutter, the click of a shutter. And I think, you know, maybe in some of the experiences that I've had or the places that I've worked, one of the things that I'm always trying to promote is the sense of beauty in every day, and kind of allowing the light that I might see in you for you to feel it and see it in yourself. And that probably helps me and heals me at the same time. If I can see somebody that, you know, it's amazing that evolution that happens when somebody is reluctant and pained and doesn't want to be photographed. They don't want to be seen. They feel uncomfortable. They feel, you know, they're not at the right place or whatever it is. And I can just say, you know, if you allow me to sort of put you at ease and feel that sense of trust. And I even take in some of the warm-up shots when they're not recognizing that I might be photographing them, and I can show them what I see, and I can show them the light that I see in their eyes, and they go and they pause, and you can, their whole body language changes, and they, you know, sometimes even quietly say, wow, there's that pause of you've just seen yourself in a different way, and I can help facilitate that. And I think that, you know, in this world of toxicity and strife and struggle, that those are really important moments of connection and beauty that we need to foster as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's two that I want to comment on specifically. This is underneath your blog section, but there's one that's called Still Barb, and it's about this lady who is suffering from Alzheimer's. So her daughter and granddaughter are there helping her out. And there's this one, a couple sentences that you write here in the middle about her talking with her granddaughter. And you mentioned, like, when she does that, there she was, still Barb, her twinkle, her smile, her movement to the music, her love of dancing. She's still there, just quiet now. And I was really moved by this mostly because I was telling you before we even started recording, but my own grandmother suffered from Alzheimer's before she passed away here last year. And that really hit home where there's those moments, those little snapshots of like, oh, there she is. And then she kind of like drops mm-hmm. away again. Mm-hmm. She's there, but quiet. And it's hard dealing with that with someone that you've known for so long. How did that project come about for you, like to go and photograph her?
Well, she is the mother of a very dear friend of mine from university, actually. And this friend has just struggled in just her family's gone through a lot of loss in the past few years. Her dad passed away suddenly while she was pregnant with her daughter that they really fought to have. And so in the midst of caring for this little girl, she lost her dad. And so Shayla, the little girl in the photos, has always been the joy of the family, and that she came early. She was quite early, but she, I think, brought this life and this joy and this focus after losing the pillar of their family that she came to kind of save everybody. So I've always been really close with this friend of mine and photographed her daughter as she's gone. And then after her dad passed away, I think that's when her mom's Alzheimer's started to present itself a little more. And so I think intuition somehow plays a role with me. Like sometimes I'll just feel this compulsion to do something and make those connections. And I just felt like with the urgency with something like Alzheimer's, I just wanted to get these moments before she continued to shift and drift farther away. So I often would go to the farm as a sort of a weekend getaway, and we'd meet up, and her mom was staying at a facility at a home near Red Deer. And so it was just, you know, it was Sunday morning and we would have had a nice breakfast together. And I would have had that in my mind. And I think I cleared it with Pam, but I just thought, you know, we've had breakfast. They're doing their thing as they were. There was nothing staged. That was just what was happening. Her mom loved music. Her mom always sang. And so we would just have on the oldie station and we'd be mm-hmm. singing and dancing. And so that's when she and her mom would start to dance. And those were the moments where, you know, she was non-vocal at that point, but you could see, you know, she still recognized her girl. She still connected with Shayla, and seeing Shayla in a way that she was coming across like a, you know, she was a caretaker for her granny. She was, you know, touching her nails and brushing her hair like that. It was just unbelievably tender. And those photos are even more special now because Barb passed away on last year on Christmas. Yep. Christmas Day. She passed away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's special for many reasons. And I think that also just the outreach and being more vocal about Alzheimer's and that younger people are dealing with it, and just the grace of my friend in being, you know, in working in her career and being a mom and caretaking for her mother, being a wife and friend. Like I'm in awe of her grace.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes I think I just am too hippy dippy about some of this stuff, but I look at all the strife and like the anger almost that it seems to be prevalent in everything that happens in today's society. But this is the type of stuff that's like, if we could just like rear back and just look at the humanity of people a little bit more, I just feel like that is so much needed in today's world.
Yeah. And why are we more afraid to, why is there hesitation? And I can be the same. Why is there a hesitation to say hippy dippy when we diminish what is vulnerability, connection, and human emotion? Everybody's craving for it. Behind all the anger are people that are in pain, are people that are feeling misunderstood or angry, or, and I was reading Brené Brown's book, Braving the Wilderness, and she said that it's going to be like, she talked about the dehumanization that's happening and how scary that is and how we've seen that enact on global scales, like Rwanda, mm-hmm. Bosnia, Canada. Like there's so many things you could say, but it's those moments of collective joy, even if it's collective pain, like a funeral. Those are the kinds of things that bring us together. And, you know, I think we need to be less, it's like nobody's afraid about saying horrible things on the internet to one another, but we're afraid to say, you know what, guys, we need more vulnerability and connection and joy in our lives because we'll come across like lightweights or something.
Right, right.
That's what we need. That's what we need. Oh.
Yeah. Well, a good segue then into this is the other one I wanted to talk about. This is your most recent one, The Art of Restoration with Jay Blades. This sounds like a really cool project you got to be a part of, because it looks like you reached out via Instagram and then were able to collaborate a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about Jay Blades himself, but you were taking photographs of him. And I love this paragraph that you write here near the end. But you say, as I circled him, brows furrowed in concentration, looking for the catchlight in his eyes, he said to me, "You're spending all this time looking for the light in other people. But what you need to do is turn that camera around on yourself. Right now, you're standing in the dark and your eyes are beaming. I don't know where you've come from or who has hurt you. We've got something special, girl. And when you catch up to yourself and realize how powerful you are, bosh, wow. Look out, world." I can't do a British accent, or else I would have tried to affect one. But I think this is like, I'm almost summarizing a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, where there's this, you take on a lot of the pain or the suffering that you see from people around you and really internalize that. And I don't know a better way to do it necessarily. but I guess just taking that quote, what was the time with Jay? How was that?
I think that was a really pivotal moment in my story. It was a day, but there was a lot of build up to it. And I think just kind of in summary, after the move, there was a change in a relationship that was really important to me. And so I then changed where I was living, and that was disruptive. And I think being in a new place, looking for a job, you know, the relationship coming apart. And I think at that time I wasn't fostering my creativity as much, because I think I was focused on other streams of income and not really listening to that part of myself. And maybe I think there was a combination of feeling like I was shrinking and I was not feeling very empowered. It was difficult. It was tumultuous and it was hard. And I think once I started to recognize that my photography and my storytelling is a gift, and not to diminish it and not to push it away, I just happened to reach out to this man on Instagram, and very quickly it was a yes. It was a, "I don't know where you are. Oh, it's a shame you're in Canada. I guess this won't happen." And I said, "I happen to be in the UK from time to time." And I had flexibility enough in my freelance schedule that I could go to the UK. I then went on to Europe and saw friends of mine from living abroad. And I had some photo shoots there. And it culminated with this day of traveling to Wolverhampton to see him in the place where he films his show Money for Nothing, which is on Netflix. And in Canada, it's on season one, but it's season six in the UK, and he's now the host. And right. he said to me, "I didn't look at your website." He said, "I work with a lot of young people and I want to see how people present themselves, how people communicate, and how you show up." And he said, "What I didn't realize was what a brilliant and talented photographer you are, but also that this kind of coming together and feeling seen by a fellow creative." And I think especially coming from a place, not that I needed the validation from anybody outside, but I think it was that much more powerful to hear this kind of message from a stranger, what I really needed to hear, doing something creative that, again, he said, you're thanking me for this opportunity. He said, "You reached out, you made this happen. You came to a country or a city that you hadn't been to an old post office." Like there, he said, there was a level of trust and courage that I can learn from when people like you come into my life. So it was extremely powerful. And what I'm working on now is trying to leverage that story and those photos to a larger audience, because I think there's resonance around this idea of what I spoke about in the blog as well, was this kintsukuri, like the Japanese art of lacquering broken pottery with gold. So I think coming from a place where I felt, you know, I had a broken heart and I was, you know, trying to find my way in the world again, that coming together and stepping into myself and feeling seen was really quite something.
So looking forward, is there anything that is on your either to-do list or things that you want to accomplish in the next year, 2 years, 3 years? What's on the horizon for you? I know you're not a planner, but I mean,
I'm not a planner. And life is, what I'm doing lately is being able to roll with the waves that life throws at you. I think that's my outlook is acknowledging that life evolves and changes and T-bones you sometimes. I'm trying to still settle with where like a sense of belonging, and I think creating a sense of home is important for me, and I'm feeling out a few places, and I'm so that is part of it. But I think kind of positioning myself as a creative, I've had the opportunity to travel with my photography and do these short kinds of projects that maybe get me out to nature or get me out to different parts of the city or country. And I'm also working with organizations like Oxfam and War Child on consulting. So I still have that connection to the humanitarian world, but I think maybe that fostering that sense of community, again, is important. And with that, the creative projects come so easily. Like I'm connected to an organization here in Ontario called Cadence, and what it is, it's an organization for first responders and veterans, and they provide peer support and kind of camaraderie and opportunities for therapy for the veterans. But just in that community, I think I've met with some veterans, and we've spoken about this idea of post-traumatic growth, and that kind of resonated with me, especially with this project that I just did with Jay Blades. It was around rebuilding and sort of this personal resurrection tour, and this idea that you can evolve from your trauma and not being trapped, particularly with veterans, in the idea that you're a vet with PTSD and that's it. And so I've photographed a couple of soldiers, actually returned vets, to show them in their environment and kind of show them where they are in terms of their journey with PTSD, and not putting a rose on it and calling it post-traumatic growth, but saying that there can be an evolution, and there can be, you can take some of the pain and the struggle and evolve from there. And that might affect your life, maybe in different ways than you'd first anticipated. So trying to challenge the stigma of the returned soldier into this more evolved, holistic person. So that's something I've been involved with. But I think a lot of the things that I have been involved with kind of evolve organically, and and with making a move maybe geographically, I think more of those will come.
That's great. So I guess lastly here then, so say there was a photographer or videographer that was coming to you and was like, I think I'm going to try and start out and try to make this a thing. Is there any advice that you would throw their way on their journey?
It's a tough one, because in some ways I feel my experience is a little bit different. But I would say that don't be afraid to, I think I probably the biggest thing for me is I feel a lot of things out. I think there's a level of like I'm my emotional intelligence, I can sort of read people and feel situations out. And I think sharpening the ability to listen to those cues is important, both when working with somebody from an artistic standpoint, but also collaborations or partnerships that feel good. And I have to say, I feel really lucky and really supported that I had a lot of mentors that were willing to collaborate with me or take time to speak with me at the early stages. So I'd like to offer that back. But I think, you know, knowing your worth, figuring out, you know, being competitive and comparable with other existing photographers, but figuring out what you value and how you want your values to be reflected in the work that you do. That really helped me sharpen in and hone what kind of people I would like to work with, knowing my time and valuing my time. Being clear about expectations. I think in the early stages, you might feel less shy about stating what it is that you need or what your direct boundaries are, or lines of like your pricing, all that kind of stuff. I think integrity and boundaries and pricing is important, but just really be forgiving. And it's okay to have a triage of incomes. It's okay. You don't have to dive in. And in fact, I wouldn't recommend diving in. Like if there's something that you're testing out, like feel things out and almost like you're building a raft before you, cut the cords, know the market. I don't know. And then really keep checking in. Like I think probably the biggest thing is the values and the check in with yourself and where you're feeling. Does the work feel good and continuing to learn and be open.
That's great.
That's a lot. That was a lot. That was a lot. I don't know.
We'll make a blog post. It's great. Well, Amy, thank you so much for spending some time here with me. I mean, this is the very first time we've ever talked, so it's good to learn some more information about you. If people wanted to find more about you, like online or follow your work online, what's some of the best ways that they can do so?
Instagram. I have an Instagram account. It's kind of a mix of, again, I think speaking to that, I think it's Amy B. And then it's my website, amybrathwaite.com. And I mix up, you know, some of the photography projects that I work with, but also I think more about kind of promoting this idea of just seeing the beauty in every day. And just, I think for me, being in nature has been a really important coping mechanism in this sort of tumultuous time when there's a lot of digital noise out there. I think connection to nature is important to me. So I bring my cell phone and I take photos for Instagram.
Sure. Sure. We all do. I mean, it's like, just the world we live in nowadays. Once again, thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
Well, there it is. Thank you so much for listening. Like I said, Amy sent a little piece of audio to me after we were done this interview. So let's go to that right now.
Hi there. I thought it would be important to add that Manitouwadge is the Ojibwe word for cave of the Great Spirit. And one other story that didn't come up, but maybe is just interesting to mention, potentially given the Calgary connection, is that in my freelance opportunities, I had the opportunity to meet Jocelyn Alice, the singer-songwriter from Calgary. I ended up joining her on a little mini tour. She went to Windsor and Detroit and opened up for Walk Off the Earth in Windsor, and she wanted me to capture the documentary style Life on the Road. So we ended up collaborating on that together, and I got to travel alongside her. And it all started because I'd sent her an Instagram, or not an Instagram, a photograph that I had taken of her just when we were out for brunch and the light was shining behind her. And she just really felt like that was one of the first times she'd ever really been seen in a photo. So that candid photograph started off this journey where I was able to follow a musician on their little tour and capture the life on the road. So that was a pretty cool opportunity. Anyway, just wanted to add that. Thanks again and talk to you soon. Bye.
Thank you for that extra little bit of audio. If you want to see Amy's work, you can go to amybrathwaite.com. There is a link in the show notes, like I've mentioned before. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to Let's Do Coffee this week. If you have suggestions for people you'd like me to talk to, even if that is you, you can send those to info@medialabyyc.com. And most importantly, thank you to you, the listener. Let other people know if you enjoy it. We'll be back again next week. Have a great day.